The reading is from Luke chapter 19, verses 28 to 44. After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' say, 'The Lord needs it.' Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owner asked them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' They replied, 'The Lord needs it.' They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down to the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voice for all the miracles they had seen. 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.' Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples.' 'I tell you,' he replied, 'if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out.' As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, 'If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you.'"
Thank you. Just a few days ago, there were a couple of smartly dressed young men standing on our doorstep. My first mistake, of course, was just to open the door. I thought that it was going to be an Amazon delivery, but it wasn't. It turns out that they were not Jehovah's Witnesses. They were actually just wanting to ask a whole series of questions about how much we pay for our gas and electricity. So my second mistake was getting drawn into a conversation with them. They had all the usual tricks: excessive politeness, first of all, and then a growing tone of sarcasm and even incredulity. "What, you don't want to find out if we might be able to save you some money?" That kind of thing. You'll have heard it, I know. In the end, they left, and they left without twisting my arm into accepting any new deals. So our faithful and friendly relationship with E.ON remains intact. But here's my question for you. Do you think that I lay awake that night worrying that I had missed the opportunity of a lifetime? The answer is no. I can promise you the answer is no, I didn't. However, second case study. 9 years ago, Jaguar Land Rover chose to stop making its classic Land Rover Defender. The last one came off the production line in Solihull in January 2016. However, there's a man in the town of Thirsk in North Yorkshire by the name of Charles Fawcett, and he had placed an order for a lot of Land Rovers shortly before that. He happens to be a man who loves Land Rovers. Also, he owns a small company where they tune and modify and upgrade vehicles and then sell them on. And he had a hunch that when production of the Land Rover Defender stopped, the value of the existing vehicles would go up. He placed an order and bought 239 Land Rover Defenders. Here's a photo, I don't know if you can see that, but there's a photo of a few of them, mostly wrapped up but uncovered so that you can see them for the photo, in a warehouse. He had to find storage for them. He didn't have a penny in the bank at that point. He borrowed every penny to buy 239 brand new Land Rover Defenders straight off the production line. And for the last 9 years, his team has been looking after them and polishing them and tuning the engines and upgrading them and actually making quite a number of adjustments to them and then selling them one by one at prices that are sometimes up to 10 times what the original price would have been. When he's asked about it, Mr. Fawcett himself just says, "Well, look, it was the chance of a lifetime. It was an opportunity that was only there for a moment, and I took it." I found that story very interesting. The New Testament has a word for opportunity. It's also translated time, and it often appears in our Bibles just as the word time. But it has a particular meaning. It means an opportune moment. A moment that is there and might pass. And when it's passed, you might have missed it. We'll come back to that word in a few minutes. We've been following, as you know, a journey in Luke's gospel with Luke as our guide. The journey is obviously approaching its destination. We are coming towards the end of the main trajectory of the journey. The distance has been substantially travelled. We've just read actually the last of the main way markers, the signposts that I mentioned are there in the text. It's there in verse 28, where Luke tells us that Jesus went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. And today, in those verses that Linda read for us, Jerusalem itself, the city, comes into sight. Now, as I said, we know that we have in our calendar 2 or 3 weeks still to go before Easter, so it's not yet Palm Sunday in our calendar. But what happens, and the reason for arranging the readings and the weeks like this, is that there is still a lot of coming and going, still to happen in the gospel account, still a lot of to and fro, into and out of the city over the course of those crucial few days. And I want to include some of that in our readings as well. When we read that phrase that Jesus goes on ahead, it seems to mean very much what we would expect it to mean as a regular phrase in English. It's a hint that now he was walking ahead on his own a little bit, and his followers were starting to lag behind. There is a strong hint of that. Mark, in his gospel, describes it slightly more strongly in chapter 10. And he gives us at least a very strong indication that they are struggling now. The disciples, the followers, are struggling. They're drawing near to Jerusalem. They are hearing these things from Jesus in his words to them, which they're struggling to understand. And if they understand a little, they are struggling to accept. Because he's starting to tell them, as we know, what is going to happen. I think we can guess at their growing sense of foreboding, even a sense of dread, a fear of what lies ahead for them. And I can picture, and probably you can as well, a heavy silence settling on the group as they walk. There are questions in their minds, but they daren't be the one to put those questions into words. But it isn't all gloom, and certainly not today of all days, because today, you know, the reading that we've just read. I reckon that there's perhaps the proverbial roller coaster of emotions, ups and downs, because at the heart of today's passage is what we always call the triumphal entry, the entry into the city. And it begins with the moment when they come round, kind of round the road skirts round the flank of the Mount of Olives, approaching Jerusalem from the east. And then suddenly, as the road curves, you would get your view of the city. And there's a photo of it in our day. And some things would be different. That great golden dome would not have been there then. And the tower blocks in the background would not have been there. But the basic shape of what they would see is still what we would see today. You can see the great platform, the great built-up platform of the temple area on the Temple Mount. It was a great shoulder of mountain, but it got built up over the centuries into that great flat platform. and that was there then and still is today. That would have been such a familiar sight. Even today, it's on all the postcards. It's easy to find this image, very easy. Moments of searching, you'll find dozens of copies of this. And the postcards all have it and have done for a long time. When they saw that view, their hearts would leap for joy. They made that journey, many of them, perhaps three times a year, all through their life, and those were times of joy. They would want to sing and dance when they came over or round the hill there and they saw that for the first time. There she is, our beloved city. So the singing, the dancing, the celebration are only natural. And also by now, it's worth remembering, by now there are a lot of people in the party. There are a lot. This is a big group of people. Many we know traveled as a group all the way together from Galilee. Others, we have every indication, others joined along the way. And besides, people are arriving at this point from all directions for the Passover anyway. So there are a lot of people on these roads, and as the roads merge and come together, they're all approaching Jerusalem. And also, there's another factor to bear in mind. From the city of Jerusalem itself, people actually came out looking for Jesus because they were looking out for him. John tells us that in his gospel. So what exactly are they celebrating? Well, Luke tells us, he makes it very clear, no less than the arrival of a king. This is the arrival of a king in the words that Luke reports. And this is a quote from Psalm 118. Which is a very strongly likely source for what's in their minds at that point. Blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. An equivalent in our world today would be when people shout out, long live the king, or God save the king. That would be what would be expected as an equivalent in our world, in our culture. Now, at this point, I want to glance back up to the start of the passage, the beginning of the passage that we read, where it's made very clear that none of this just happened by chance. Jesus set the whole thing up. As they are nearing Jerusalem, it's not yet come into sight. They're on the other side of the Mount of Olives. They are near two villages, Bethany and Bethphage. Jesus stops and he sends for the donkey. Now the whole group obviously then has to wait for the donkey to arrive. So there is thought going into this. He stops the whole party on the road and says, we're waiting here. Also, he already knows, doesn't he, that there is a donkey there available in that village for him to borrow. And the disciples can't help noticing, we read it in verse 32, not there on the screen, the very next verse, verse 32, they find everything. The two who go into the village find everything exactly as he had told them. And they noticed that, and it ends up being recorded for us by Luke. It's often asked, of course, is this supernatural knowledge, or is this an arrangement Jesus has made beforehand? I think there's a very simple answer to that. This is Jesus. So it could be either. And I think we should leave it at that because it's left open for us. And a very interesting suggestion I've come across is that in actual fact, perhaps Luke himself leaves it open to make us ponder, which of those is it? It could be either equally. It's 50-50 because neither of them is more difficult than the other for Jesus. What is important for us to understand, here's where our attention must be though, the whole thing is deliberate. I like to imagine what was going on slightly behind the scenes. If the camera is on Jesus, what are the disciples saying to each other as they stand there waiting while the other two have gone into the village to get the donkey? I can imagine they're looking at each other and someone glances across and says, he's up to something. He's up to something. Jesus is up to something. But what? What is he up to? That's the question. He's putting on a show. He's putting on a spectacle. And the intended audience is the city of Jerusalem. Also, partly, perhaps, the people traveling with him, the many people on the road. But I think the primary audience is the city of Jerusalem. This is a message for them. And that's why he wanted a donkey as his main prop. Because the donkey, you'll know this, the donkey is a very clear reference to a very well-known prophecy. Everyone in Jerusalem knew this. Zechariah 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. Look, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. They knew that prophecy. Because they had no king, and they hadn't had a king for hundreds of years, and they longed for the return of a king. And when he came, he would be on a donkey. Now, kings would not usually ride a donkey. By then, in the history of the entire region, by then a king would have ridden a horse or been on a chariot. So a king on a donkey is a unique feature which Zechariah had pointed them to. Look, your king comes to you. This is a royal procession. In our world, in the centre of London, if you see the guards out there, and they are in their full dress uniform, and they are marching, and behind the guards there are those eight white horses drawing the gold state coach. You know how to interpret that, don't you? It's obvious what is going on. That is not the mayor of London and his daughters out for a shopping trip. It is a royal occasion. It's a state occasion. And what Jesus did that day is no less obvious than that and no less real than that. So when we read these verses, we should not be thinking just for this, just for these moments, for this day, this afternoon perhaps, we shouldn't be thinking of a rabbi and his followers. That, of course, was the situation on all of the other days, but not this day. This is not a rabbi and his followers that we are being shown here. It is a king and his guard of honor. That's what Jesus is saying. It's an announcement from him. This is a ceremonial procession of a head of state. And he is saying to the city of Jerusalem, folks, read Zechariah 9 again. Read it about your messianic king. I am that king. Meanwhile, there is a little bit more to add to that from this passage. I'm pulling in one or two things now around that, but that's the central feature. In the business of borrowing the donkey, in those verses from, I suppose, 29 to 31 is the business at the start of the passage, there is another very clear claim. Jesus says to his two disciples in verse 31, if anyone challenges you, just say, the Lord needs it. And then those words, the Lord needs it, are repeated a couple of verses later in verse 34, when we are told that it happened exactly as he had said it would, we have those words repeated, the Lord needs it. It's very rare for Jesus to refer to himself as the Lord. He almost never does. What do we understand by this word, the Lord? It's a word that can actually have a wide range of meanings. It can mean the owner. So it could be just the owner needs it. But Luke tells us that the donkey's owners are actually right there. It can also mean master. It can mean Lord in the sense that we use the word as in the local Lord of the manor. And it's used throughout Scripture, of course, to refer directly to God himself. So it has that wide range of meanings, but whichever one of those meanings you choose, it could be translated owner, master, Lord, but whichever you picture in your mind as you read it, the implication is this. If the Lord needs your donkey, you lend it to him. You give it up unquestioningly, gladly, immediately. If the Lord needs that thing of yours, you give it to him. That's the implication here. When we turn our attention to the end of the passage, I'm afraid the mood all changes again. I meant to do that and highlight the words there. First of all, the emphasis on the king, and then secondly, the emphasis on the Lord, the master, the owner. But when we come to the end of the passage, the mood changes again. And I did want to include this full set of attendant events in our reading this morning, because Jesus himself is now overcome with grief. It's as if, it seems to me, the heaviness that we interpret as being possibly over the disciples earlier on now settles on him, suddenly hits him. And this is an overwhelming wave of sorrow and sadness. The word here in verse 41 for wept is not the word that suggests quietly shedding a tear, a silent, private tear. It's the word for loud sobbing and wailing. It's that kind of grief. So this is public. This is heard by all around. What we should understand that's going on here is this, I think. Jesus is the true heir to all of the promises that God had made to King David, first and foremost, and to his dynasty, to his successors. So if Jesus is the true heir to all of that, then this is his capital city. This is the Prince of Jerusalem approaching its gates. And the right thing to happen, what should have happened that day or that week, is that the Prince of Jerusalem enters his city and is crowned king. We should understand that is what should have happened. But it didn't, did it? And Jesus knew that it wasn't going to. The city will reject him, and he knows that. The authorities, the religious leaders, the political leaders, and almost the entire population of Jerusalem will seize him and throw him out of the city and have him killed. But those tears and cries of grief are not for himself. This is not self-pity. Those tears are for Jerusalem itself, for Jerusalem and its people, because of the awful consequences that lie ahead for them. God's punishment will be swift within a generation and will be terrible. And Jesus knows that. Some of his comments, there are whole chapters in the Gospels which focus on what lies ahead specifically for Jerusalem in that generation. And it's punishment for what? Verse 44. And some of it, I fear, you can't read there. Verse 44 reads, "They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you." The word that is translated God's coming to you is often a word for a visitation. You didn't recognize the time of God's visitation. And the word time there is the word for opportune moment. The moment that you should have responded to and didn't. That's why there is such tragedy in his heart and in his words there. Things are getting tense. Things are getting very tense now in these readings as we enter the last stages of the journey. And so they must. They are bound to. It's inevitable because there are such serious matters at stake. I'm just going to draw a few strands from the many that are there in this passage. Things for us to be aware of. First of all, thinking specifically of the disciples of Jesus, of the followers, those who have been with him on the road. Some traveled all the way from Galilee with him. Some joined along the way. For us, just as for them, there are times when our hearts might be terribly heavy with fear, with dread, with sorrow. Those times will take place. We must remember it's a journey. On a journey, the landscape changes, doesn't it? As long as you keep going. If you stop and stand still, then the landscape doesn't change. But if you keep walking, if you keep going, the landscape changes. And one of the simple messages of Scripture is, keep going for today, because tomorrow it might be different. Psalm 30, verse 5, it's a lovely verse. I think this sounds an encouraging note to us. Weeping may remain for a night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. It's not a promise that everything will be in a 24-hour cycle. It's a promise that everything has its time. And even the darkest valleys of our life have their time. And there are what Churchill referred to as the broad sunlit uplands on the other side of the valley. They are there. Some circumstances, I'm convinced, are intended to teach us things. But others, other situations may well be just things for us to endure. And we will come out stronger if we do. We might not always realize it, but we will. Also, keep the final destination in mind. I don't know if you recall, but as we got underway on this journey a few weeks ago, I pointed out that the final destination was not the suffering, was it? It was the victory that lay beyond the suffering. And we must keep that in mind, as Jesus was able to keep it in mind in his journey. And also remember, we don't walk this road alone. Thinking of the Pharisees crop up again. They keep on appearing. They're not in every passage, they're not on every page of the gospel accounts, but they're in quite a lot of the chapters that we're presented with by the gospel writers. They get involved at this point in verse 39. They're watching, and they don't like all the celebration, and they say, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." We do need to be alert to the danger of becoming one of them. Maybe in a very small way, but it exists. There is the temptation sometimes to remain detached, to stand back a bit and to observe others, and to observe others with a little bit of a frown on our face and an opinion of what other people should or shouldn't be doing. When, what is our first duty? Our first duty is to watch and listen to Jesus himself. Give our attention fully to following him. I mentioned last week that we have that verse from Hebrews, very well known. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. Well, when we're reading the Gospels, fix our eyes on him means ask what are his reactions? What is his opinion? What is his view? What is his explanation? Go with that first and foremost before forming our own opinions of other things that we read. So there is a danger there, perhaps more than we might think sometimes. I'm thinking also, of course, of the people of Jerusalem. They feature also here in the abstract, in a way, in this passage. For them, the truth at this point is very, very somber indeed. This is not for them an isolated moment of opportunity. It's not something that just suddenly appeared out of the blue and then was gone and they missed their chance. We mustn't think of that. So the parallel with the story of the Land Rovers that I put up at the start, the parallel falls down there. This is actually the climax of a long history and a well-settled habit of ignoring God's messengers. Actually, of ill-treating God's messengers and of ignoring and sidestepping God's word to them. Everything that he had patiently sent to them over the years and the centuries, Jesus says they are guilty of abandoning, of rejecting, and of paying no attention to. So it's not an isolated moment. And that's where the tragedy, I think, lies in this. Do they also stand as a warning to us? I would say they do. I would say they do, an urgent warning. Because we've seen, I think, I hope we have, that in this scene, Jesus makes a very, very powerful declaration. We have, on the surface in this scene, a clear declaration that he is Lord, he is King, and he is God. And for everyone who comes into contact with him, everything depends on how they react to those claims. Everything depends on whether we will recognize, and recognize means acknowledge, those claims that he makes, the Lord, the King, and God himself. Let's bow our heads in prayer.